Hi, I am Connor Friedersdorf, a staff writer at The Atlantic Magazine.
Hi, I'm Alex Schmidt, and I'm a reporter for NPR and other outlets.
And we have a bunch of topics to talk about today. We're going to start with comments. Blogging Heads has a thriving commenter community, and there have recently been some upgrades to the comment section. And you have thoughts, Alex, about the evolution of comments over time on the internet?
I do. I'll admit it's kind of, I have a collection of screenshots that I've taken over time of different sort of comments on websites. And I realized as I was looking through them, they are all YouTube comments. And I think, which actually I do think is probably a good little limited sample pool, but all pertaining to like the thumbs up thing, and people love to kind of play with the thumbs up thing, and I've kind of noticed over time that, you know, thumbs up if whatever brought you here, and people do that, and then like people have sort of started critiquing the thumbs up thing and the way people do thumbs up, and I don't know, I'm extrapolating for the entire internet from this one little tiny thing, but it seems that the reaction to that has gotten a bit more interesting, and I sense that commenting communities are evolving in a way that is a bit more intelligent than they have been, which I think is natural and to be expected as people kind of see the same things happening over and over in commenting sections on the internet, that they would get better at it and smarter at it just as they become more familiar with it.
I think the ideology of commenting has changed. What I mean by that is I remember early on in the blogosphere, when I started reading it, it was shortly after 9/11, and blogs came up in a way where they were really trying to distinguish themselves from the dread mainstream media, and comments were a big part of how they were different. They prided themselves on being more open, on having a two-way communication stream. And the ideology of it, and one that I used to share, was that it was anathema to ever delete any kind of a comment. Part of your accountability was that anyone could come in and write anything, and the idea was that you shouldn't go down the road of having the proprietor of a site delete comments because they couldn't be trusted. It was an accountability thing, and I think that almost no one thinks that anymore. I think that now it's generally accepted that policing comments in various ways is necessary if you don't want your comment section to devolve into just awfulness. And I think YouTube is actually often cited as the worst comment section, maybe by some people. But I didn't understand. So you can thumbs up any video on YouTube, right? So how were people playing off that exactly?
Yeah, so, I mean, like one person will say, like, thumbs up if, you know, I don't know, ESPN.com brought you here. And, like, then 60 people will thumbs up it because, you know, ESPN.com brought you there. And, like, slowly other people have been kind of getting more witty with that. Like, thumbs up if you don't care who brought you here. Or, like, I don't know, just kind of, I remember when, there was one comment that said, that was the top-ranked comment that said, I remember when dumb comments didn't get to be top ranked or something, you know, and I sort of, maybe the fact that YouTube is kind of like the worst sort of commenting playground, the fact that people are getting a bit more witty and a bit more savvy with it is sort of, that's the best place to see something like that. I don't know, but I agree with you that it is more accepted to have comments policed, although not overall. A lot of people are quite incensed by the fact that they don't have free rein on websites to say whatever they want. So
yes, and one thing that confuses me actually, maybe it's just because I am a writer who has outlets to say what I want in the main body of posts, but I don't understand the psychology of some internet commenters. I just don't get it. I mean, I notice the character of comments being different at different places that I freelance. You know, the Atlantic is different than the Daily Beast where I used to write, which is different than, Politics Daily was, and just about every place has a little bit different character. But what's consistent across all of these places is this strange compulsion to score partisan points in comment sections on any article that it is at all related to politics. So, you know, you write a piece about Republican candidate does this or Barack Obama does that, and inevitably you get people who will say, you know, seemingly without even reading the article, oh, you're just saying that because you're a liberal media elitist, or oh, you're just saying that because you're a wingnut conservative or whatever. What I don't understand about that is it doesn't seem like a very good use of anyone's time. It's not as if you're persuading anyone by going into comments and just asserting that someone is, you know, it doesn't even have to be partisan politics. You're not persuading anyone by going into comments and sort of insulting them with one line or whatever. And of course, there are some constructive commenters, but I guess I don't get the psychology of the ones that don't even attempt anything that resembles something that's trying to be persuasive or to make a cogent comment or whatever. But you have a sunnier outlook on comment sections, I feel like. When you freelance, you tend to like reading the comments.
Not only when I freelance. I think, like, I don't want to say I waste a huge amount of time reading comments, but I spend an enormous amount of time reading comments. On almost every article I read that has commenting, I read the comments. And I'm actually really interested in the people that don't, and, like, what that's about, people who read comments and people who don't. But for me, I think oftentimes I find some of the most insightful things in the comments. Certainly, that's the case with my own reporting. You know, so an angle that I hadn't even thought of is often brought to light by an astute commenter. So I think, you know, your point that you don't understand people kind of coming in and making some random remark, why do they do that? I think possibly because they're hoping to sway folks who are comment readers. While I mean, I do agree with you that some people are completely belligerent, and I actually think it would be quite interesting to track some of those people down and, like, do a story about them. Like, who are these crazy, the really, really crazy out there people that are doing these comments and hiding behind pseudonyms? Right. Like, who are they? I've never really heard anything about that. But, you know, why do people post? I think it's quite obvious, you know, that they have, often they have a perspective worth sharing, or, you know, perspective that might sway a reader in their direction.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, even in my articles on politics, there are certainly, you know, if I skip around in the comments and I sort of look for the longer entries and try to pick out the ones that will have something valuable to say and to give those some attention when I have time to do it. I think part of the difference between our experiences is that I'm often writing about things that have that are in the world of partisan politics or ideological battles. You're often not doing that. You're often writing about things that don't have a direct bearing on whether Republicans or Democrats are the good guys or the bad guys, or
Whether
conservatives or liberals are good or bad. And when I write about other things, you know, when I write about why I prefer to work in coffee shops, for example, and why I think it's sometimes more efficient to do that there. On those sorts of offbeat articles, I'll get almost all good comments, and the troll community seems not at all present. So maybe you're the smart one. You just write things that put you in touch with the better side of humanity than
that
I do.
That may be.
So if you were building your own comment section, if you were building a site, do you have any sense of what you would do?
We don't have that many options. You can either go a very expensive route, which is to have moderation on if you're like a high volume producer of content, a high volume commenting community, it's very expensive to have moderation on every single comment that's posted. The other option is to do flagging, in which every comment gets published and questionable material is flagged by the community and then brought to a moderator's attention. And I guess that's right. Probably, you know, the only option if you don't have a ton of money. But there are innovative systems, possibly you know, in the works, or certainly in the works, possibly soon to become reality, one of which is called Hypothesis, hypothesis.is is the website.
Okay.
That site is kind of trying to do annotation for the entire internet, which sort of, I guess if you could imagine like a layer that would be turned on over the whole internet, with experts who are sort of voted up by the community, in a dig-like fashion, I suppose, able to annotate the entire internet. That's an example of a site that's really trying to solve the commenting and quality content conundrum on a very wide scale. So it's not just, an issue that's limited to comments. It's an issue that's limited to the quality of content across the internet. You know, we'll see what happens. I think there's some exciting stuff in the works.
Yeah. I wonder if we're ever going to see video comments. It seems like cameras are increasingly built into every electronic device that we're carrying, and computers, of course. All the Macs have computers, I think, now. And I wonder how the dynamic would change if people were leaving little video snippets, you know, recording themselves in much the way that we're doing on Bloggingheads and leaving them under an article. I realize that this would be a little bit less efficient in terms of being able to scroll through and see what people are saying. Text is a lot more efficient than video. But I think that if a site tried it, that they would probably get a higher quality of comments. I think people would be less willing to be trolls if they were putting their face there and speaking into a camera and they knew that they were going to appear in a medium that could be taken from there and put elsewhere. But then you're
cutting out people who maybe aren't great looking or don't want to post a video for whatever other reason. But I agree with you. Yeah, if you had to own your identity, of course. And I think some websites, notably the LA Times, have tried experiments of commenting in which you can only log in with your Facebook profile, which I should have mentioned that before, is another option to sort of limiting trollish comments. And I think it works across the board, you know, to have people log in with Facebook because that's an identity verification tool.
Yeah. In theory, if I were running a big website like the LA Times, and I don't actually know how feasible this is, but what I would like to have is for people, I would almost want a troll index for different commenters, right? So that if someone was just being belligerent all the time, you wouldn't kick them out of the community. You would just, their troll index would go up and up and up as people voted their comments being trollish. And over time, what would happen is that you could just filter out people above a certain troll index. You could sort of decide for yourself how tame or how polemical you wanted the comment section to be.
I like that idea. I think, of course, you know, it's very open to abuse if somebody just happens to have a differing political opinion from yours. You could call them a troll, but I like the idea of a troll index. I think it's really funny.
Let's keep on the topic of the digital world. And you and I were talking earlier about the boundaries that people set in the digital world,
or don't.
I don't know if I set boundaries in the digital world, but you do. Tell us a little bit about what you've done to control technology's role in your life.
So one of the things that I should say, I'm kind of both a techie person and also like a tech phobic person, or at least a tech concerned person. So one of the things I've done is I don't have wireless internet in my apartment, which is a way for me to escape the internet, force myself to escape the internet when I really want to focus on writing or whatever it is. I also only recently switched from a BlackBerry which had a terrible browser, and on purpose I wanted to have a terrible browser, to a better Droid phone. Although, this is another limitation that I've imposed on myself. I initially, or not quite, but I initially got for my birthday a Samsung Galaxy phone, which is this gigantic brick of a thing and really good for people who watch like TV and movies and stuff. And I don't watch those things on my phone. And I also like having the keyboard, or at least the keyboard option. So I kind of downgraded to a Droid 4. I've kind of imposed these limits on myself. I also have a really small capacity iPod, for example, which forces me to swap out my music choices and forces me to continually listen to different albums, because I have so few on there. I swap them out more often. So those are a few.
So that's a deliberate choice for you.
Yes.
And so you do have internet in your apartment. You have wired internet. You just don't have wireless.
That's right.
And that's enough for you to be able to unplug? Do you just
Move locations.
Sit in a different spot?
I go and sit on my couch. I do not sit on my desk. Sit at my desk, and that's enough. I mean, it's enough to force me to just focus on writing.
Okay. So this is unusual, I think. I mean, most people, I guess there are people who have that program on their computer where they can shut off the internet for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the idea of escaping the internet is common enough. It's obviously a time suck and can draw you into all sorts of procrastination. But your experience has been that people have reacted negatively to your taking control of your tech life.
Yeah, that's kind of sort of a disturbing aspect of this whole thing is, you know, people who come into my apartment and want to use the wireless and they tell them I don't have it are, you know, fair enough. You know, they're surprised. Most people do have wireless, but some people get kind of offended that I do this. And, you know, for example, when I went into the Verizon store to sort of downgrade, quote unquote, my Samsung Galaxy to this other phone, the guy at the store would not do the exchange for me because he said the Samsung Galaxy is the hottest phone out there. And how could I possibly, you know, want to change? And he actually wouldn't do it. I had to come back on another day and get a different person to help me.
Really?
I did. I think, you know, that aspect to me is perhaps revealing as to just the way people just let technology waves sort of overtake them, slide over them, and don't really consider the things that they're adopting in life. And, you know, of course, I think there are a moment comes where you have to get with the trend, and I've certainly done that. I resisted having an email-enabled device for a long time, and then I realized it was a huge hindrance. It was preventing me from actually making plans to meet up with people, and at that point I changed, and there's some stuff that you can't avoid sort of upgrading or downgrading to, however you look at it. And that's, you know, that's fine. That happens, but there are other ways that you can sort of assert your own technology taste, but the wide majority of people who have heard that I do these things are surprised, bordering on offended. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I have a sense that it's because perhaps, I mean, maybe it's because they've never thought of it themselves and, you know, don't like that idea,
you know,
that they're kind of being swept over by this wave. I don't know.
I think you're right that people react with, I don't know quite what word to use. I don't know if offense is the right word or if they react with bemusement or, but I do think it's there. I do think that, and I see it actually, I've been on both sides of it. My fiance and I have been moving around to a bunch of different places, subletting in different cities, and often we don't have a television. And people think that this is nuts, that we don't have a TV for much of the time, and that we, you know, we'll go months at a time living someplace and not turn on a TV, not watch TV. And it's interesting because my parents actually, when they first got married, they didn't have a TV for a couple years, and it drove their parents nuts. Their parents actually just came over one day and bought them a TV because they couldn't stand the idea of them living without it. And I don't know what that impulse is, the impulse of seeing that other people lack this technology that is a big part of your life. I don't know what motivates it, but I feel it sometimes. I mean, my grandparents, who live next door to my parents, so I get to see them a whole lot, and they love to follow my writing. They always have since I was a little kid, I guess, and especially since I became a professional journalist. And, of course, you know, I have one set of grandparents that are savvy enough online that they have an email account and they can go and read my stuff online, and they get my little email newsletter that I send out with journalism picks. And my other grandparents are, I guess I would call them tech phobic. They, my grandmother is terrified that if she has a computer in her house, it will somehow suck up the paperwork in her office and she'll be the victim of identity theft. And my grandpa isn't afraid in that way, but he is definitely, he doesn't, it's just not his thing. And it's funny because he's a very mechanically intelligent person. He spent most of his life working his way up in construction from a carpenter to a general contractor. I mean, he literally built his own house. He can fix just about anything you would want to fix. He can install, you know, a tile floor or cabinets or whatever. But a laptop is a technology that is just sort of beyond his grasp. And, you know, I'll sit down with my grandparents and I'll show them things like I remember showing them Google Earth and how amazed they were that they could sort of zoom in from space and see their own street from above. We're kind of disturbed, as a lot of people were, but also amazed. But part of me wants them to be able to do all of the small things that I know that they would really enjoy doing if they had internet access, you know, whether it's talking to my sister when she's been abroad at various points and getting to see her face on Skype, or whether it's, you know, emailing or reading articles that they would enjoy. And so, I don't know, maybe it's different sorts of emotions that we're talking
about.
Yeah,
I think there's a difference between not having access or understanding of technology and making very conscientious decisions based on things that you do understand. So I can certainly understand your impulse to say, hey, here are all these things you can do. Why don't you give them a shot? And maybe they'll right. want to and maybe they won't, you know. But I think that's different from, you know, saying, I know how to do this. I just don't want to.
Right. Well, and this is happening more and more quickly, right? We are a generation that went from cell phones being a kind of quirky thing that not very many people had to being a sort of normal thing that some people had and some didn't. And then at some point there was this shift, right, where you had to have a cell phone. And if you didn't have it, your friends would get upset with you because it was a pain to get in touch with you. It was harder to make plans. It was harder to coordinate. People started having the mindset that, you know, you wouldn't pick a meeting place. You would just arrive and then call the person on a cell phone and find them. And in a very short amount of time, everything changed. Now it's almost unthinkable not to have a cell phone. And it's almost as if we couldn't function, right? We couldn't figure out how to meet people. We couldn't figure out how to call and say, I'm 5 minutes late or whatever without this. And I wonder if we're just in for a succession of these kinds of things coming at us faster and faster where, you know, oh, well, you have to have a tablet computer now because it does this thing.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and that's the way technology progresses is, you know, like I said, you know, you reach sort of a breaking point where you realize, no, I have to have an internet-enabled device, or, you know, I can't meet up with so-and-so at the mall or whatever it is. Your life is hindered because of that. On the other hand, you know, let's say, you know, you're back in, I don't know, whenever landline phones came about, and you said, okay, I got to get a landline phone, but I don't want one in every single room. So, like, I think right. there are still kind of barriers that people may have and things that they may do while still adopting new technologies, but still staying in a realm where they are asserting a bit more control over those technologies rather than letting them completely rule their lives. So I think there's a balance.
Yeah, and a kind of funny offshoot of this, the Atlantic's Tech Channel had a post the other day about a Tumblr. I don't even know if it's Tumblr. Maybe it's just a straightforward blog, but it's called, I'm trying to remember the exact name. It's I think it's called Free Cabin Porn, maybe.
Yeah, I've seen
and
it. Mm-hmm.
It's part of this trend of posting pictures of cabins in various places. And these are cool-looking structures, but part of what's going on, or so this piece argued, was that people are romanticizing the sort of Walden-esque existence. This is more and more romanticized the more connected we become. The fantasy is now to get away and to live in a structure that has no wires coming into it at all. And I think, actually, this is another thing that people are really divided about. I have some friends who are very tied to technology, would start to go stir-crazy if they were away from their iPhone for a whole evening and they could, you know, check it when they went to the bathroom at dinner or you know, check their email or whatever. And I don't know. People predicted, actually, that I would be one of those people. And when I went to Spain on vacation for a few weeks, I guess it's been 6 months or so now, people said, oh, you're going to have a really hard time disconnecting. And I've got to say, I did not have a hard time disconnecting at all. It was so nice to have a break from the internet, to not know what was going on in the world, to not pay attention to the news. And
That's interesting. I think probably the people who are fantasizing about the cabin porn are people like you, I would imagine. You know, people who really are kind of on all the time. I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, like maybe folks like me who have these sort of self-imposed boundaries, maybe I don't fantasize about those things because I kind of already feel balanced. I don't know. I don't fantasize about disconnecting, like, you know, but I have no illusions that I'm very dependent on this stuff as well. And, you know, there's even more boundaries that I would probably like to impose.
Right. Well, one other technological boundary you would like to impose is to do away with the self-flushing toilet. so why don't you tell us about that?
I mean, it's so there's kind of this sort of like little line of thought that some green buildings are water wasting. And one of my kind of like pet issues is water waste. I'm like very aware of that. And
you're a good Californian. Ricky Raindrop has done his.
Thank you.
Done his job.
So, you know, when you go into one of these buildings with self-flushing toilets, they flush, I think, like an average of 3 times or something. And, you know, apparently faucets that are that have the sensors also, they turn on at like the highest possible pressure every time.
Okay.
And so those are apparently also water wasting. So I think in kind of like this quest for like this green hygienic building, we're also kind of ignoring water issues. This isn't like a huge issue for me, but I do find it interesting that that's a choice that's been made.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess there is this trade-off in bathrooms between efficiency and hygiene,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, the trade-off is I don't have to touch the faucet, but at the same time, maybe it wastes some water. I don't really know I don't know how I'd make that trade-off. actually, I think the best bathrooms are the ones where they have this sort of the actual toilet part separated, and then you come out into a common area where you wash your hands, and there are no doors separating you from the rest of the building. But anyway, so I guess what drives me crazy in American construction is something that I never even realized until the last time that I was traveling abroad. And it had been, I guess, it had been about 6 or 7 years between times when I was visiting Spain. And in that time, that country got just tons more energy efficient in a bunch of small ways that don't seem to have trade-offs to me, actually, that just seem to be all benefit, and it's just a matter of doing these things. One of those ways was that at malls, we stayed in this hotel in Valencia that was on the top floor of a mall. It was kind of a very strange setup, but it had, you know, 4 or 5 levels that you traversed via escalator, and the escalators, unlike escalators in the United States, it's just kind of run full speed all of the time. If no one was on these escalators, they would stop. And Then when you walked, there was a little sensor on the bottom step, and as you crossed the threshold, it would trip the sensor, and it would start moving again. Another thing was that in bathrooms, you walked into a bathroom, and the lights were off. And as you opened the door, a little sensor, you know, recognized that you were coming in and turned the lights on, and they would stay on for, you know, whatever amount of time. But of course, in the United States, in most commercial properties and most restaurants or offices, you go into the bathroom and the light's just on all day, even though people aren't in there all day. And it's those kinds of things where, despite my general libertarian feelings on stuff, it seems like it's just this collective action problem where it's probably a good idea to just mandate that commercial buildings after a certain date are going to have these lights that, you know, go on automatically. Like, these seem like I can't think, you know, I sort of get riled up by the light bulb laws because I am very into nice, warm light. Yeah. I hate the compact fluorescent bulbs, and I kind of generally think that if you're going to make people be more carbon friendly, that's fine, and it's you know, maybe necessary, but do it by imposing a general carbon tax so that people's specific decisions aren't impacted. But yeah, something like the bathroom lights, I don't know. I can't imagine that anyone has a preference for the lights being on when they're not in the bathroom. It just seems like an easy thing that we could do. You know, much like the way that in restaurants now, and this is something that the United States has done, they generally don't bring you water unless you ask for it and save, you know, a bunch of water from the dishes that they don't have to wash. And in hotels where if you leave your towel on the floor, they'll bring you a new one. If you hang it up, then they'll not bring you a new one. It seems like there's a lot of gain to be gotten from these kinds of things.
I don't know. I mean, who knows how big the gain is. But I think, you know, with something like the water or the towel thing, there's almost no cost to those institutions to adopt practices like that. Whereas,
right, probably cost savings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas something like ripping out the automatically flushing toilets or, you know, putting in these light things is a cost. And so I do think that your key thought is mandating, because it's not going to happen if there's a cost otherwise.
Right. Yeah, so I am actually doing this Blogging Heads from outside on my back deck.
Lovely.
in a lovely day here, and it's, what, March... March 19th.
I know where you're going with this.
Still winter.
I know where you're going.
It's still winter in much of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And here in sunny Southern California, it's just a beautiful day. And yet, you, Alex Schmidt, who grew up in L.A. and who lives in L.A. again now, you don't think that the weather in L.A. is good. And I don't understand it, because you and I were in grad school together. And I remember you walking into the classroom in Rob Boynton's class. I don't even remember what the class was. But I remember you walking in, bundled up against the cold, cruel New York City winter. And surely you can see that California weather is fantastic.
I will say that California weather is superior to East Coast weather, and I've never denied that notion. However, and let me just say this, it's not that I take issue with LA weather per se, it's that I take issue with people's perceptions of LA weather, and I do think there is a distinction. While it may be lovely outside today, and actually, I was outside this morning, and it was freezing. I was wearing, like, a really heavy jacket with a hood, and I had to have the hood on, so it's not that warm right now. So, you know, and I would point out your comment that the weather right now is perfect as proof of my theory, because, you know, even when it's cold outside, people think it's warm here. That's the weird thing about it. And, people kind of have this amnesia about cold weather in LA. They forget that it gets cold at night. They forget that it gets cold sometimes. They forget that we have a rainy season that's very unpredictable and sometimes very cold. And, you know, I think it's all part of this LA myth. That's my thing. That's my little chip on my shoulder.
Yeah, see, even your terms, like a rainy season that's very unpredictable, I don't know. I think that sometimes you hear on a Tuesday that maybe it's going to rain on Friday, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. It's nothing like in D.C. where I lived for a couple of years, and, you know, you'll wake up in the morning and it'll be just a perfectly sunny day with not a cloud in the sky, and you'll go on a walk and you'll be a couple miles from home, and suddenly storm clouds will roll in and there will be thunder and lightning and even hail on one occasion. On a 4th of July once, I was in D.C. and it started hailing on a day that it had been 90 degrees probably, I don't know, an hour earlier. I never got used to the idea of checking the weather report in the morning and carrying an umbrella even when there are no clouds in the sky. In California, you kind of know if it's going to rain. You are seldom caught out in a storm. I think people's impression of the weather in LA is pretty accurate. That it's just generally nice and warm, and you can generally wear short sleeves and rainbow sandals all year round, and you can get a nice hat like I've got here.
I actually know that what you're saying is not correct, Connor. Because I got kind of so obsessed with this issue that I called up the California State Meteorologist.
Oh, no, you have data.
I do. I have data. He supported my notion that it's true. And in fact, you know, the weather in LA has gotten colder over the past, I think, 10 years than it used to be on average. Because I remember in college being able to lay out on the roof of my apartment building every single day in February. And that just kind of felt like something I couldn't do nowadays. Like, it just felt like it's probably too cold in February. And I actually checked in, and it's true. The average temperature has dropped. But even among that, we've always had crazy freezing spells in Los Angeles, in Southern California. I'm really talking about Southern California, not Northern California. Even snow some years has happened. I asked this guy, where does this idea that it's sunny and warm year-round and night-round, where does this idea come from? And he said, it's a myth we tell people because the average sounds so great. The average temperature in Southern California is 72 degrees. But what we don't tell people, and I'm quoting him, is that that's the middle point of really crazy weather that happens around it. And so it is absolutely a myth that gets propagated, and people believe it, and you're one of those people. And, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've, you know, gone out with a friend at night, for example, to like one of these outdoor movies that they do in LA, and they're wearing a tank top. And I'm like, you've lived in LA for 8 years, you know, it's going to be really cold. And like, yet they believe that.
It's true that LA has a desert climate where during the winter it gets colder at night than you might expect,
always,
especially if you're in
always.
I don't know. We'll maybe just have to keep agreeing to disagree on this.
I don't disagree with you that it's better here. I don't disagree with you that it's better. It's better here. Than elsewhere. It's just not perfect.
Another topic on our list, does LA or New York have a bigger impact on American culture? What is the bigger driver? You always hear about how it's the quote-unquote liberal elites who are controlling the culture in this country. But among the coastal dwelling elites, among Californians and New Yorkers, who has the bigger impact? You think New York?
Yeah, I think New York. I mean, I don't like the idea that one place has a monopoly, but I do think it's New York, for sure. There's no question about it. I mean, if you want to be, and I'm talking right now, let's say we're talking about kind of like making it as a fine artist. Let's just say we're talking about that. You want to be exhibited in New York. That's kind of like the apex, or at least it has to be something you achieve at one point. Whereas, you know, you could go your whole career without being exhibited in LA and do just fine as long as you have your New York creds.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the case for California, here it is. I think that high culture, New York is is the driver of high culture in America. If you're going to be a fine artist, if you're going to be in theater, if you're going to be in ballet, New York is the place that you've got to go, and I wouldn't dispute that. But I don't think high culture really drives American culture, much as I would love it if America's magazines set the cultural agenda for the country, just from a selfish perspective of being a magazine writer, I don't think it's so. And I think that what we see on TV and what we see in the movies has a far bigger impact that is underappreciated among intellectuals. And I think that the combination of that, the combination of California's demographic diversity and the way that it has, it is at the leading edge of both Hispanic and Asian cultures coming to this country and incorporating their traditions and their food and their cultural identities into the sort of larger American cultural identity, and Silicon Valley too, and all the technology companies that have been in California that are based in California. If you're Mark Zuckerberg and you are at Harvard in the middle of the East Coast elite, what do you do when you start this technology company? You move across the country to California, and you are surrounded by other Californians, and you're living in a house with less good weather than LA, but pretty good weather still up in Silicon Valley. And surely the combination of Hollywood movies and TV shows produced in LA and Google and Facebook are far and away more influential than theater and fine arts and the various high art. Donald Rumsfeld might call it old art in the way that he calls it old Europe.
Maybe. Yeah,
so that's
I think first thing, I don't know if, I mean, I've only lived in New York, California, and Philadelphia. That's it. I don't know about you, but I think that our perceptions are colored by that fact, so let's just put that out there. But, the other thing, too, I would say is you're kind of making the case for California as a state culture driver, whereas when we say New York, we're not talking about the state of New York. We're talking about New York City. And I think that, California doesn't even see itself as a kind of combined thing.
We were talking the other day about this rivalry between San Francisco. And
yeah. So I
a one-sided rivalry.
Yeah, exactly. LA doesn't care. I think, that identity doesn't really even exist for us. So to ask other people to think of California as this cultural driver, I don't really know if it works. I mean, it'd be cool. Like I love that I live in California, and I think it's a cool state in concept. All the sort of, westward expansion stuff and all of the myth of the state and everything. I love it. I love all California history and the missions, and there's so much to it. But I don't think collectively we feel that way.
I don't know. I think that there is actually a California pride that I see more often when I'm outside of California. I mean, certainly when I went to work at the Atlantic in Washington, D.C., working in the Watergate, and I knew pretty quickly who all the other Californians were, and there were a lot of them working at the Atlantic, and they're from Northern and Southern California. They kind of identified as Californians, and the same is true when I have traveled abroad. These sandals that I name-checked earlier, rainbow sandals, they're made in San Clemente and are very comfortable leather sandals. And I guess they sell them everywhere now, or at least in other places aside from California. But you can get them cheap at the factory here. And, man, they identify you immediately as a Californian, or at least they used to. And no one ever asks you if you're outside of California, whether you're from Southern or Northern California. They just complain that they miss good Mexican food,
mm-hmm.
and you identify that way. I think that that is the great connector of
Mexican food,
of Bay Area in LA. Yeah, I do. I think an appreciation for avocados, Mexican food, a sort of horror at the politics of our state, but a simultaneous apathy because it's, again, it's sunny. This is a piece that I wrote in Esquire a while back that I posit that one of the reasons that the California government is so messed up is because it's very hard to think that anything is wrong when it's sunny outside all the time. It doesn't snow, and you know the dysfunctional government doesn't send the plows. That happens in colder places. Here, it's like
Why does the government exist if we don't have snow?
Messed up,
yeah.
Until the power goes out, and then you're like, the power's going out. Like every 4 days, it's time to recall the governor. Are there any movie stars around to take his place?
I don't think we, like, you know, in terms of Silicon Valley, like, and Hollywood, I think those are kind of like the two big cultural forces you cite as being Californian.
Yeah.
I think you're correct. We don't see those as products of California per se.
And also I think we underestimate the cultural impact that these companies have, the cultural impact that Google and Facebook especially. I don't know. You could make a case that Facebook is the most culturally transformative company in America. And I mean, if Facebook wasn't it, who would be?
I mean, I don't really know what you mean by culturally transformative.
But what I mean is that all over America, in just about every city, at least any city beyond a single street where you can just walk to anybody's house in 2 seconds, people are on Facebook and they are connecting with their friend group digitally. And people my parents' age are reconnecting with people that they haven't spoken to in years that were in their high school class. And it's just changed the way that people interact in their peer groups. It's changed how people communicate. It's changed the people that they're in touch with in their lives and the number of people that they keep in touch with. And, you know, obviously there are various horror stories about bullying on Facebook. And I think that that's maybe a broader change that is the internet as a whole.
Where you can't escape
this online world where you can be bullied in a much more public way.
I
think Facebook has been huge.
Yeah, I mean, I would maybe call that more socially transformative rather than culturally. I don't know. But, I agree with you again that we don't see that as a creation of California. We don't.
I agree with that. And, I mean, it started at Harvard, so maybe we shouldn't, but it certainly wasn't a transformative thing in America then, and it is now.
Right.
I'm just trying to think of who I would pick for the most transformative company if it wasn't Facebook. I mean, certainly Google deserves mention, and I suppose even Starbucks changed the way that people interact in daily life, you know, created or recreated coffee house culture and made a sort of new third place in American life. I don't know. I'm sure that one of the far above average commenters at Blogging Heads will jump into comments and tell me some company that I'm stupidly missing that
Apple,
has changed culture way
Apple,
more.
Dude. Apple. Another California
company. Yeah, but I don't know. Do you think that's true? Has Apple...
I don't know. And also, I don't even want to talk about Apple, Google, and Facebook. I disagree with you. They get talked about so much. They get talked about a lot.
Yeah. I just think Apple makes better versions of things that I would use otherwise, even if Apple didn't exist. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know.
So I'm trying to think, did we have any other topics we were discussing?
We talked about the iPod Shuffle, but that was kind of related to an earlier topic. I don't know if we want to talk about that anymore.
Yeah, I think we should talk about that because you had one of the things when we were prepping for this that I asked you is there any technology that you think people would benefit by giving up that everyone is using, but if they thought about it and if they seize control of their digital life or their life of their technological life, they would be better off without this thing. And you said that the shuffle function on the iPod was your pick. And
yes.
And it made sense to me only after you explained why. So why don't you explain that?
I guess, you know, everybody knows that you can access music more easily in the digital era. And, you know, my quality of listening, I think, while my discovery is much wider, my quality of listening, I don't think is better. And the main reason I cite for that is that, when I was listening to CDs and tapes, that was a while back, but, you know, I was forced to listen to albums all the way through, and I honestly, you know, there just aren't that many albums that I've really given a shot to since, you know, getting an iPod. I'll hear one song or maybe a couple songs on an album, and those are the ones I love, and I don't really give the other songs a chance. And previously, when I was forced to listen to whole albums, the songs that I liked best often were not the ones that I liked the most when I first started listening to them. And so...
So just to be clear, are you still buying whole albums, or are you... Or is this partly because you're buying iTunes?
I actually am buying whole albums, and in fact, I bought one. It's not a new album, but it's a Citizen Cope album, and I really love one song on the album. And true to form, I have really not listened to the rest of it, or the songs that I have listened to on the rest of it, I haven't given a chance to, and have kind of written off. Whereas in a previous era, I would have given them more of a shot, and who knows, I might have like a deeper appreciation for these other songs and the album as a whole.
And it makes intuitive sense when you're talking about the LP era or the tape era when it was really hard to skip between songs, or at least not really hard, but you know, relatively hard. But it was pretty easy to skip a song on a CD, right?
Yeah, but I think in that case, you know, you have 12 songs you're skipping among rather than right. Hundreds or thousands on an iPod. And, you know, these days what I find myself doing is putting my iPod on shuffle and just clicking through the songs until I get to one that I really want to hear. And it's just this yucky instant gratification relationship that I have with my music that's just more shallow than the relationship I had with my music in the past.
Well, and so, a long time ago we had talked about how you liked listening to the radio despite having a big music collection on your iPod, because there was a certain experience listening to the radio that you couldn't get elsewhere, and that experience is the surprise of hearing a song that you didn't expect to hear and that you really like and that you hadn't heard in a while, and it just sort of comes out of nowhere. And you enjoy listening to that song coming out of the blue more than you would enjoy listening to that song if you were to go and deliberately put it on.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
And it seems like having a big music collection and having your iPod set to shuffle maybe would mimic this radio experience, but does it?
No, I don't think it does, because, you know, on the radio you can't skip to the next song, and on your shuffle you can. So, you know...
Right, so it's partly suffering through the bad songs that makes the experience...
Maybe, but, you know, like, the bad songs can become good songs if you give them enough of a chance. I think that's the point. I barely give stuff a chance. And I think other people are in the same boat. Like, I hear, you know, oh my God, did you hear this new song? You know, like the Got Ye, someone that I used to know, somebody that I used to know, which is such a great song. And like, I've listened to it like 100 times every day for the past week. And I'm like, okay, next, you know? And that, I never used to be like that. I listened to stuff, I don't know. In a better way, I think.
Yeah, huh. It's you know, I think I've had, I don't know if I've had the same experience. Some of my favorite albums actually are ones that I took when I traveled around Europe when I was about 23 or 24, and I had a Discman, and I had maybe room for, I don't know, 20 CDs, and those are albums that I've both listened to over and over again, and also that I associate with a lot of the places I was traveling. Now, I thought very carefully about what CDs to take on that trip, and I think that was part of why I ended up enjoying them so much. I also delved deep into my mom's record collection, which is fantastic, and you know, it's how I discovered Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and it's how I discovered a lot of bands from that era, and their whole catalogs. But I think I'm less inclined than you to search out novelty in music all the time, and I think that the existence of iTunes and my iPod has made me do that more than I otherwise would have. In other words, I'll sort of get content listening to the same album over and over again for a long time, or listening to, you know, a lot of Bob Dylan over and over again for a long time or whatever. And I don't know, the existence of iTunes has sort of made me go and, you know, I'll hear a Jay-Z song on the radio, and then I'll go into iTunes and I'll listen to little snippets from a bunch of his old albums, and then I'll buy a couple songs from, like, a random early album, and I'll listen to it, and then that'll make me want to buy the whole album, and I will. And then I have that same experience of listening to music and getting to like songs that I didn't like at first, to the degree that I'll sort of force myself to listen to songs that I don't like sometimes, because invariably I'll end up liking some of them eventually. And I wonder why that is. I would love to hear like a cognitive neuroscientist explain to me why it is that you start out not liking a song and then you like it. Isn't there some historical example of this where people's ears weren't attuned to something and it just sounded just awful? The audience.
It was like a Radio Lab episode about that or something recently. I remember hearing about that. But you know, that's really I find it very interesting that you do. Do that kind of purposeful listening. And I think, you know, a lot of what I've described as sort of like my self-imposed technological borders have to do with the fact that I'm very weak. I am weak. And, you know, I need to impose those on myself. I don't know if I'm in the minority, you know, maybe a lot of people are able to kind of, maybe other people are able to curb technology all on their own, just with their own habits. And I'm very interested to know about that.
Yeah, well, I think it's almost different weaknesses, because for me, as someone who enjoys listening to albums all the way through, I find that I do it less than I would like to. But the difference for me is that I used to commute a long way to work every day. Before I moved to the East Coast, I was living in Claremont and living in L.A. and living in Orange County and driving to Ontario every day. And I had maybe like a 40-minute commute one way, maybe like almost an hour the other way. And then I was driving around doing a bunch of reporting. And I find driving just very conducive to discovering new music or listening to the music that I haven't listened to a lot before. Now, when I work from home and I don't drive very much, it's great. I love walking, having a very walkable life and not having to fight traffic. But I do miss the music aspect of driving. I think there's nothing like driving and listening to music. It's certainly the place where I prefer to listen to music. And to a lesser extent, now I find myself setting aside time on flights to catch up on albums and sitting and listening to an album the whole way through. But for me, it's very hard to sit in my house and listen to an album the whole way through. I don't know if it's that I lack the attention span or that there's not – that I want distractions while listening to music.
I think the car, you know, one of the great – kind of sad ironies of audio, you know, and I'm including radio and podcasts in this, is that the car is like the best thing those mediums have going. I find that disturbing because, you know, radio is my thing and audio is my thing. And like, I wish we had better public transportation and more people rode bikes. I mean, that's not true. You know, this stuff can work on bikes too and public transportation as well. But there is something to driving a car and having just that exact right amount of visual distraction where you can still focus on an audio product, whether it's music or radio or podcast.
I wonder if the self-driving car would be the death of... The death of NPR.
Probably. NPR's, or not NPR, but like terrestrial radio is, you know, probably going to go away sooner rather than later, you know, for obvious reasons. But the car is, when people, you know, I constantly find people saying, like, I moved to New York, I don't drive anymore, I don't listen to the radio anymore, I don't listen to public radio. Like, it's very common, I hear it all the time.
And you've thought a lot about doing radio journalism, and don't you have some kind of theory about the importance of forming habits in audio listening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this probably goes back to the whole purposeful use of technology kind of thoughts. But, you know, I'm a very avid podcast listener, but that wasn't something that happened overnight. It was something, and it's not something that does happen easily. Like, I schedule time for them, and I have my routine every week where, you know, when I go to the gym, that's like my sacred podcast time. And it's not easy to develop those types of routines and those types of listening times that are necessary right. for consuming podcasts on a regular basis. And I don't really think that producers of radio or producers of podcasts have given much or any thought to cultivating those types of habits. I'd love to see more of that.
Well, so speaking of these habits, I should mention that Blogging Hence has a new innovation that people should check out on the page where you can put in an RSS feed. You can get this by RSS feed, you can get the video by RSS, you can get the audio by RSS, you can sign up for the podcast on iTunes, and you can do that not only for the whole Blogging Heads site now, but you can do it for the individual shows. I encourage you to do it for this one. And as we close, Alex, why don't you tell people a few of the audio podcasts that they should check out if they are interested in the medium?
Well, if you are a California person, I recommend the California Report. It's barely heard in LA, but heard quite prominently throughout the state on public radio stations. I recommend On the Media. I listen to it religiously. It's produced by WNYC, Radiolab, and This American Life, obviously. And I also enjoy Left, Right, and Center, produced by KCRW.
All right. Well, it was fun talking. I hope we do it again sometime. And I hope I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. You too. Bye.